You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at the action the world took in the 1980s that stopped the ozone hole from growing. Now, we're talking this week with the candidates for state attorney general about their campaigns and some of the big issues facing the Justice Department here in Wisconsin. Yesterday, we talked to Democratic incumbent Josh Call. Now we'll hear from Eric Toney, Fond du Lac County District Attorney and a Republican running for state attorney general. District Attorney Toney, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me this afternoon.
You've been Fond du Lac County DA for about a decade now. For those not from your area, can you connect the dots? How would your time in your current office shape your role if you're elected as attorney general?
Well, my dad spent over 30 years as a police officer. I spent about 2.5 years in private practice before being elected district attorney, doing criminal defense, mental health, and juvenile law. And in a decade as the district attorney of Fond du Lac County, you name it, I've personally prosecuted the cases in court using just about every resource our Department of Justice has to offer, fighting for public safety and justice on behalf of victims to keep our community safe. And that's what we need to get back to doing at our Department of Justice to make sure we're supporting our law enforcement, our prosecutors, and making sure our Department of Justice is running as efficiently as possible to end the historic violence and drug epidemic that we're seeing here in Wisconsin, coupling that with enforcing the rule of law, that we don't pick and choose when to do that. Those are priorities that we need to have in making public safety the number one priority at our Department of Justice, and giving our Attorney General's office the original prosecution authority in Milwaukee County to augment and help take on cases that the Milwaukee DA's office might be unable or unwilling to prosecute, because that Milwaukee crime ends up spreading and bleeding across Wisconsin. And if we can protect Milwaukee, we can protect all of Wisconsin, because it's sad and tragic that Milwaukee is on pace for its third straight murder record and is likely to cross 200 murders for the first time in the city's history, not to mention the fentanyl that is killing kids and methamphetamine that is destroying families at historic record pace.
What specific measures would you take when it came to gun violence in particular, a big part of those homicide numbers you're talking about?
What we have to do is enforce the laws that we have on the books, but also add mandatory minimums for violent criminals that are using guns, felon in possession of firearms, to make sure they know there are serious consequences to these types of crimes. You know, I was in Milwaukee on Juneteenth this year talking to folks in the street about what their number one concern was, and it was people using guns where parents don't feel safe in their homes, they don't feel safe in their vehicles, and they won't let children go to parks because they're afraid of stray bullets. We've had about over 20 kids murdered in Milwaukee this year. It's like a slow moving mass shooting moving through Milwaukee, and we need to protect people in Milwaukee, because I refuse to accept this violence as the new normal.
The current Attorney General, Josh Call, has filed a lawsuit to block the state's 1849 law banning almost all abortions. That, of course, came into effect with the Dobbs ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. He cites 1985 legislation that gives less stringent restrictions on abortion. What are your thoughts on the reasoning in that suit?
Well, the job of the Attorney General is to enforce the rule of law, and I trust our district attorneys and prosecutors across Wisconsin to use their discretion and take things on a case-by-case basis. And I've always said, if the legislature passes any additional exceptions, I will defend them as Attorney General. But it seems pretty clear our Attorney General knows he's wrong on the law, because if you think you're right on the law, you ask the court for an injunction, a restraining order, something to enjoin or stop the enforcement of a law. And that wasn't done in this case, because it seems evident that he knows he's wrong on the law. And we have technically competing statutes all throughout our criminal code, with the different types of batteries that we have, financial crimes, a multitude of different homicides, where a prosecutor has the ability to pick which charge they may or may not file with all kinds of different criminal laws. But the job of the Attorney General is to enforce the rule of law, not pick and choose when to do that. And the Attorney General got asked that question in the debate we did last week, and how he said he had to enforce the law related to somebody with sexual assault convictions in the employment side of things, and now he wants to pick and choose when to enforce the rule of law. We leave the lawmaking with the legislature, not activist judges, not activist attorney generals, but with the legislature.
With the 1849 law, what do you envision as the right way for the attorney general to assist in investigations and prosecutions related to that abortion law?
It's no different than anything else. We take things on a case-by-case basis, And I'm not aware of a single prosecution that's been commenced or investigation here in Wisconsin since the change in the law. So it's not something I think most law enforcement or prosecutors across the state have dealt with. And it will likely continue to be that, where we're focused on the major public safety issues that we have in Wisconsin and driving down the historic amount of violence and drugs. And the Attorney General in Chapter 165 is obligated to give guidance to district attorneys across Wisconsin. We don't pick and choose when we decide to give guidance, and we need an attorney general that's committed to enforcing the rule of law, not just when they agree. And if you look at my record as a district attorney of Fond du Lac County, it's just that, enforcing the rule of law, not just when it's popular with my own party, where we took a position on certain COVID-related things during the first 13 days with an even-handed approach of enforcing the rule of law, not just when we agreed with it. And that's exactly what we need at our Department of Justice, an attorney general that will enforce the rule of law, not picking and choosing when to do so.
Talking to Eric Toney, Republican candidate for Attorney General of Wisconsin, currently Fond du Lac County District Attorney. One of the jobs of the Attorney General is to decide when to participate in federal lawsuits. We often see attorneys general around the country lining up on one side or another. What would you weigh in deciding whether to bring Wisconsin on to one side or another of a federal case?
Well, it's important for attorneys general in the United States to look at, is there federal or state overreach in protecting our constitutional rights and liberties, and make sure that if that is broken, that it has a direct impact on people here in Wisconsin. But my number one focus is public safety, which unfortunately has not been our attorney general's number one focus. He made a campaign promise to fix our crime labs, and he broke his number one campaign promise, where our crime labs are less efficient, taking longer to test many categories of items, including that crucial DNA evidence, and he's testing thousands of less items. PolitiFact reported that Attorney General Brad Schimmel, our previous attorney general, averaged turnaround time for DNA analysis about 50 days. Under our current attorney general, that time is more than doubled. It's exploded to 115 days and testing thousands of less items. We need an attorney general that's going to focus on public safety, because our crime labs have the more resources they did under our prior attorney general, and there's no excuse for the mismanagement by our attorney general of our crime labs and the Division of Criminal Investigation. The director of that agency, Tina Virgil, in March said that only 88 out of 113 of those law enforcement positions were filled at the DCI agency, reducing resources to law enforcement and prosecutors. And now we've seen a direct consequence of that mismanagement, where there is a over 1,000 case backlog of child sex predator cases, which we call internet crimes against children. And these are cases where somebody is potentially sexually assaulting a child, soliciting a child for sex, downloading, manufacturing, distributing, created child pornography. We need an attorney general that's going to make public safety the number one priority. And I will never allow those law enforcement positions to go unfilled the way our attorney general has. That doesn't even take into account the over 30% vacancy rate as of March, according to a Wisconsin State Journal story from the frontline criminal litigation prosecutors at our Department of Justice, that during historic violence in a drug epidemic, our attorney general has reduced resources by not even trying to fill these positions. And I will not allow that to happen on my watch as attorney general.
Getting back to my question about federal lawsuits, one prominent national lawsuit was filed by the attorney general in Texas, saying, in effect, zeroing out Wisconsin's presidential vote outcome. Attorney General Call didn't join in that lawsuit on the side of the plaintiff. Would you have, do you think he should have?
I would not join in it as attorney general. I've been the most vocal statewide Republican candidate saying that we cannot and should not decertify the election, and that there's been no widespread voter fraud that would have overturned the results. I am prosecuting voter fraud cases in Wisconsin to protect the integrity of our election process. And our attorney general right now, back in 2016, he was representing Hillary Clinton in court during the presidential recount here in Wisconsin. And he argued in court that humans could better tell the intent of voters arguing for a hand recount. That's not how he talks now, as he also was advocating for a special prosecutor, special counsel to investigate the 2016 presidential election. And he appears to be like a plastic bag blowing in the wind, depending on what direction the liberal politics go. We need an attorney general that's going to be consistent in enforcing the rule of law. And that's what my record is as the district attorney of Fond du Lac County, where I have bipartisan support, Republicans, independents, sheriffs and DAs across Wisconsin that know we need a prosecutor and not a politician leading our Department of Justice. 83% of our sheriffs have endorsed me. I have about as many Democrat law enforcement endorsements as our attorney general has total. And over 100 of our sheriffs, police chiefs, and DAs have endorsed me. The unanimous endorsement from the Wisconsin Fraternal Order of Police, the Wisconsin Troopers Association, and police chief law enforcement associations from across Wisconsin, because our law enforcement trust me to lead our Department of Justice and have seen the public safety failures of our attorney general, and they do not trust him to be our top cop leading our Department of Justice.
District Attorney Toney, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Eric Toney, Republican running for state attorney general, currently the Fond du Lac County District Attorney. Yesterday, we heard from Democratic incumbent Josh Call. Coming up, NASA announced last week that the ozone hole shrank for the second year in a row. We'll take a look at the history of global action in the 1980s that made that happen. That's next year on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. NASA announced last week that the ozone hole is slightly smaller than it was last year, continuing a long-term trend of shrinking over the past few years. In the 1980s, scientists announced that the world was on track to deplete the ozone layer of the atmosphere, which protects the Earth and the people who live on it from dangerous ultraviolet or UV rays. If you haven't heard about the hole in the ozone layer for a while, that's in part because the world took some action and it stopped growing. Some environmental experts say that effort could be a model for the effort to slow down climate change. Tracy Holloway is professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Tracy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, scientists working in Antarctica started noticing this hole in the ozone layer in the 70s. Can you take us back to the 70s and 80s and what we were figuring out, what was going wrong?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. Back in the 1970s, they realized that certain chemicals had the potential to deplete the protective ozone layer up in the stratosphere. And this is the layer of the atmosphere that filters UV light. It kind of acts like a natural sunblock. So in the 1970s, they were concerned that over the long term, this could be a problem. And actually, they put in place some early preventive initiatives. But then in 1985, everyone was so surprised to actually see a big hole forming over Antarctica, because until 1985, it had been perceived as more of a slow and steady change that we would expect. And it was really put the atmospheric science community in an uproar in 1985 with the discovery of this hole. And it was discovered by a team of British scientists. Then a U.S. expedition went down led by Susan Solomon, who is now a professor at MIT. And then they went back through archived satellite data, which they had thrown away digitally because they thought it was so crazy. And then they went back and saw that actually satellites had been seeing it since the 1970s. They just didn't know it. And so really, it was discovered all of a sudden in 1985, and 2 years later, there was a binding international treaty to control the chemicals that caused the ozone hole, and that was known as the Montreal Protocol.
Can you talk a little bit about those chemicals, the CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons? They were in refrigerants. They were in like Aquanet, the official hairspray of the early 1980s, as I recall. What is this class of chemicals? Why were they so harmful?
Yeah, so, you know, at the time, they were considered miracle chemicals because they were so stable that they could go into fires and be used in fire extinguishers. They could be used in electronics, air conditioning, refrigeration, even, you know, asthma inhalers. They were used to deliver the medicine. So they were so stable that they didn't pose an immediate risk to humans, which was good. But the bad news is they were so stable, they just hung around the atmosphere until they mixed slowly but surely up to the upper layer of the atmosphere, the stratosphere, and then they were zapped with high energy radiation from the sun. And this high energy radiation broke them apart in ways that people didn't predict ahead of time. And that set off a chain of chemical reactions. And it's very interesting because even one of these CFC molecules can destroy thousands upon thousands of ozone molecules, because the molecule gets sort of destroyed and recreated while the ozone is just destroyed.
Let's get back to that timeline. You mentioned 1987, the Montreal Protocol. 2 years after this was discovered as an urgent threat, what happened? What did this protocol, the cooperation, look like?
Yeah, so countries from around the world, including the United States, signed on to this protocol, which pledged to ramp down the use of chlorofluorocarbons. And in some cases, it was replacing these with other chemicals. In some cases, it was changing the process. But basically, we were just swapping in chemical substitutes. So we all still use air conditioning. We all still use our refrigerators. It's just that the chemicals, you know, behind the scenes have changed out.
We're talking to Tracy Holloway from UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, looking at efforts to stop the spread of an ozone hole and how they've worked over time. And Tracy, could you talk about the long-term impact? Now, here we are, 2022. How much impact has that Montreal Protocol had?
Yeah, it's really been a success story, because once the decision was made to limit these CFCs, countries signed on, technologies were adopted, and the emissions, the release of these chemicals into the atmosphere, dropped off precipitously. Now we're emitting almost nothing. However, the chemicals that were released back in the day are still floating around in the upper atmosphere. And that's the problem. They have an average lifetime of about 50 years, some much longer. And so we have to wait for the ozone hole to catch up to the policies from the 80s and the early 90s. It is getting better. It's shrinking slowly but surely each year. And that's because the damaging chemicals are going down bit by bit each year.
Now, one of the replacement chemicals, HFCs, are like CFCs, I think, also a greenhouse gas. So we're looking at, a second step of solutions here. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, I often talk in my classes at UW-Madison about these three different problems: the ozone hole, climate change, and, you know, air quality, like the air pollution that makes us sick. And for the most part, these are three different questions and have three different problems and different chemicals and different policy solutions, but they overlap in interesting ways. And CFCs that destroyed the ozone layer are actually also greenhouse gases. So without really trying to, the Montreal Protocol also was a step forward in addressing climate change, because it phased out an important category of greenhouse gases. Now, unfortunately, the replacement HFCs are good for ozone, but still bad for climate. So, you know, we're still looking for what's that next step, what's that next issue on the horizon. But the biggest issue for climate change is carbon dioxide. And the good news is we have a lot of different ways to reduce carbon dioxide emissions.
Do you think that the Montreal Protocol could be a model for international cooperation on climate change and those carbon dioxide emissions you were just talking about?
I think that it has a lot of lessons that can be applied to the climate problem. One, the good news story. And sometimes it's easy to focus on how difficult a problem is, but we see from the Montreal Protocol, the policy was signed in 1987. That was a turning point, and things are getting better slowly, but we are on the path to recovery. And I think that that's the right mindset to have around climate change. We have to turn the corner. And once we turn the corner, it's not like everything will go back to the climate of the last 30 years, but we're on the track to making things better.
Do you worry that there could be a sense of defeatism with a big problem like climate change, that we need, you know, a good news story like the ozone hole efforts to remind us that we can make a difference?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's important to recognize the problem, because if you don't acknowledge the problem, it's hard to start thinking about a solution. But if there's no hope, then it's hard for people to rally behind actually getting something done. And when it comes to climate change, there's a lot of reasons for hope. We have so many great solutions ready to go. As soon as there's the policy in place to mandate these solutions, just like there was for the climate, for the ozone hole, I think that the solutions will, you know, come off the shelf and be deployed. I'll just note that actually, the ozone hole isn't the only big success story. Another good one is the Clean Air Act of 1970. Once that was passed, our air started getting cleaner and cleaner, and our life expectancy started going up. So we have success stories, and I am optimistic that, you know, we can make climate change a success story as well.
In just our last minute or so, you mentioned solutions waiting on the shelf for the will to use them. What would be your top priority when it comes to a climate change solution?
I think that the sort of the two-pronged solution is to move our electricity system to zero carbon and try to move all of our energy use to electricity, because if we're getting cars and home heating and other sources that tend to be electric, and then we have a clean electric grid, that's the 1-2 punch we need to solve climate change.
Tracy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob. It was a real pleasure.
That's Tracy Holloway, professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. She talked to us about what it's taken to keep the ozone hole from growing after NASA announced that it shrank again in 2022. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the days are getting shorter. For some people, that can lead to feelings of fatigue, depression, and other symptoms. We'll check out the causes of seasonal affective disorder and get some advice on dealing with it. Do you have a story to share or a question for our guest tomorrow? Love to hear from you right now. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Do you experience, or you feel like you experience, seasonal affective disorder? Have you found ways to help deal with it? Things that made a difference for you? Let us know, and we could share them with other listeners. Again, you can email ideas@wpr.org. Also, tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check in on the home stretch toward the midterm elections and the factors that could sway the big statewide races, especially for governor and U.S. Senate here in Wisconsin. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a psychology professor joins the show to look at some of the things that lead to school shootings and ways to prevent them in the first place. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the lead up to next week's election has seen lots of misinformation spreading. We'll learn more about the impact it has and how to push back against it. First, last month, at the site of a school shooting in South St. Louis, the teenage perpetrator left a note in his car, which the police commissioner shared some of during a press conference. The note referred to a lack of friend and family connections and feelings of isolation. Our next guest has studied the psychology of school shooters and found that those feelings were common threads. And while those feelings can't in and of themselves predict a school shooting, they may offer insight in ways to prevent them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about why school shootings happen, what they have in common? Do you work at a school? What is the administration, the staff doing to help address things like mental health and bullying and isolation among students? Call in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Robin Kowalski is Centennial Professor in the Department of Psychology at Clemson University. Robin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
You've done a lot of research on these issues. And one thing I want to get at the start is something you're not saying we can do. The idea I think we get from TV that we can profile, that we can have a psychological set of characteristics to say, aha, this person is likely to become a school shooter. Why is that so difficult to do?
That's exactly right, because there's not a one size fits all model. And, you know, you mentioned the bullying and you mentioned the mental health issues. And, you know, the research that we found has shown that there are indeed certain, we'll call them correlates, or, you know, maybe antecedent conditions, maybe predictors. But, you know, there's a lot of children who were bullied, for example, mm-hmm. or young people who don't go on to become school shooters. There's, you know, so many young people who have mental health issues who subsequently do not go on to become school shooters. So while those factors are correlated along with some others, you know, that doesn't allow us to profile somebody just because they have those particular features as part of their, you know, their well-being.
That said, that doesn't mean there's nothing we can do. When you study people who end up becoming perpetrators in schools, and you've also looked at colleges, are there themes you see that we could say, yes, if we could treat the student body as a whole, if we could change the experience for them, that we might help prevent these situations?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, let's stick with what we were just talking about with the bullying and the mental health. You know, so you just said that we don't want to profile and we can't profile, but we can deal with some of these underlying conditions. You know, at least in the state that I live in South Carolina, and the state law is that schools have to have some kind of anti-bullying program. So I go and speak to a lot of different schools, maybe an hour long presentation, but me going and talking about bullying for an hour, that should just be the beginning of, you know, a 9 month long, or for you know, schools that have a year long program of bullying intervention. You know, for mental health issues, there should be mental health programs. And part of that should be what, it's a relatively recent field in psychology, which is focusing on psychological mattering. You know, what can we do to increase the likelihood that children and young adults, and adults for that matter, feel like they matter, you know, feel like they belong. We've done some recent research also showing that, you know, feeling that you don't matter is correlated with suicidal ideation and potentially suicidal attempts. So this concept that mattering is important and that belonging is important, you know, and that feeling marginalized puts people at risk for all sorts of things, that's where schools need to devote some of their attention.
I wanted to key in on that idea of mattering, of feeling like people are worth something to other people. How can a school cultivate that kind of feeling in all of their students?
So there's several ways that, and some schools are already doing it. I do want to point that out. There's some schools throughout the country that are already paying attention to this. There are buttons that say you matter, and they'll have, you know, students wear those buttons, or they'll pass them out for anybody that wants to wear them. There's one school in Long Island, and they have each student create like a puzzle piece that, you know, basically, you know, if I were to create my puzzle piece, it would show what makes me unique. And then they put the puzzle pieces together. And what it shows is that, you know, you can't have the entire puzzle without each of the individual pieces, each of the unique pieces that make up the whole. And that makes each person feel special and realize that in spite of the fact that each person is maybe different from another person, or have their own quirks or eccentricities or things that make them, you know, stand out from other people, that, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So that's a good example of a way that schools can go about making young people feel like they matter.
You mentioned that mental illness in some cases can correlate with the risk of a school shooting, but not necessarily be the cause. I wonder, if is this a second order thing where if I'm a kid and I'm dealing with a mental health problem, and that is obvious in some way to other students, and they, you know, maybe with meaning to, maybe not, exclude me, there's that lack of mattering. There's that isolation that can become a problem.
That's exactly right. And, you know, that makes the person with the underlying psychological problem feel like they don't matter and that they don't belong. And, you know, there's sort of an antecedent and a consequence issue. So it can be the antecedent, but then as a result of, you know, children who maybe have anxiety or depression to begin with may even behave in certain ways that lead them to be marginalized. But then once they sort of distance themselves, then the other children or young people at the school feel like, oh, they're different. I'm not going to, it just becomes this vicious cycle.
With this focus on mattering, on making kids feel like they matter, obviously the percentage of children who end up being involved in these shootings is very, very small. Do we get benefits outside of preventing, say, a school shooting, or, as you mentioned, suicide prevention? What are some of the wider benefits of this focus on matter?
Even if we weren't talking about school shootings, everybody can benefit from a focus on mattering. You know, it takes so little to make somebody feel that they're important, to make somebody feel that they matter. Just a small act of kindness. You know, I teach an 8 o'clock class every semester. And, you know, these are college kids, and I tell them regularly, more than once a semester, you know, that before we come, it's a small class, has about 25 students in it. And I tell them that, you know, we have no idea what any of the 26, counting me, 26 of us have gone through before we even walk in that class at 8 o'clock in the morning. And it's just, you know, all it takes is just asking somebody how they're doing, or just a small gesture. It takes so little effort to make somebody feel that they matter. And again, without knowing what somebody's going through, that that little effort can make all of the difference, whether we're talking about school shootings or just making somebody feel like they belong, or maybe somebody's going through some family situation. But those things also can tie into, you know, we have sort of key, you know, correlates that we know tie into school shootings, but we know that many of the school shooters have also had family problems and, you know, a whole host of other issues that play into it. So again, the mattering, whether we're talking about school shooters or not, the mattering can play into every situation.
We're talking to Robin Kowalski, professor of psychology at Clemson University. She's helping us understand some of the underlying conditions, situations that can lead to school shootings, how we can better identify and address them to prevent more shootings from happening. And as she's saying, get other benefits for kids. You can join in at 800-642-1234. This idea of making kids feel like they matter at home, in school, is this something you've run into? Have you made an effort to do this as a parent, a grandparent, a teacher, a school counselor, or a fellow student yourself? Are you seeing these kind of ideas in your school? What questions do you have for our guest about how this all works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about underlying social and psychological conditions that can make school shootings more likely and how we can prevent them from happening. Robin Kowalski is with us, professor of psychology at Clemson University. She's done a lot of research on this over the years. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at school for you or your kid. Do you feel like there was a good environment where people felt like they belonged? What can make it better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions, or email ideas@WPR.org. Robin, hopefully we create these environments where a potential school shooting isn't about to happen. You've also looked, though, at some of the red flags, the warning signs. What can school communities, you know, teachers, parents, fellow students watch out for to suggest that something might be happening in the near future?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So in the vast majority of cases, there are, in fact, warning signs, but so often they're ignored. You know, we often use the phrase leakage to refer to those warning signs. And it could be that maybe the person who ultimately becomes a school shooter has created a video, or maybe they've left a note, or maybe they've written a journal. And again, oftentimes these appear on social media, or maybe they've, on their social media profile, they're posting, you know, images of guns, or, you know, that weren't there, you know, they hadn't been posting like that before. Maybe they're bragging about plans that they have. You know, maybe they're just disclosing to one or two of their, you know, acquaintances or friends what they're planning to do. And there's, you know, in schools, oftentimes there's this code of silence where, you know, I've heard this, but I really don't want to say anything. Or maybe other students aren't taking it seriously, but it needs to be taken seriously. But even if it is, maybe there's this fear of, oh, well, you know, maybe I really do believe them, but I'm afraid that, you know, if I tell and they find out that I'm the one that told, you know, maybe I'll be putting myself at risk. So one thing that schools can do is they can make an anonymous reporting system where students who hear something or see something who are afraid to make their identity known can report what they have seen or heard to school administrators without revealing their identity.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Mequon. Lynn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Lynn?
Well, it's a wonderful topic to talk about, but what my feeling is, and a lot of these, like that last suggestion is really kind of good, but what I would say is that people that have mental health, and especially kids that have bad situations at home, the teachers can help in that they recognize it. But I think it takes a team of people and a lot of effort. It's nice for kids to say, hi, how are you, and that sort of thing. But kids that are rejected because they're different, they're going to be rejected. And it takes a lot of effort and a lot of thought to help those people. And it probably takes a team of people. And as a former educator, I'll say, number one, it takes a lot of money, but there are no quick fixes. And I think great reporting if you see a kid like that, but expecting kids that are not different to make a difference I don't think it's impossible, but it's pretty hard.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Robin.
Yeah, so I don't disagree that it certainly takes a village. But, you know, I would encourage the caller to watch a TED Talk that's called I Was Almost a School Shooter. It's about Aaron Stark. I would encourage all viewers to watch this TED Talk. It's super powerful. But Aaron Stark talks about he had a horrendous home situation. And he was really suicidal. He had plans to shoot up his school. And he had one friend that reached out to him. And I'm not saying that that's going to, you know, that one friend is going to work for everybody, but at least in that particular case, it did. It's a very, very powerful TED Talk. But I think that the caller makes a good point. It certainly takes, mental health issues are certainly not easily dealt with.
Lynn, thanks a lot for that call. Lynn also brings up a resource question. Do schools have enough resources to devote to, you know, creating that welcoming situation, to providing more help to that kid who needs it?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that schools have done, and we want to be careful that we don't exacerbate the mental health issues with some of the attempts we make to intervene, you know, like with lockdown drills and, metal detectors and things like that. And I don't want anybody listening to this to misunderstand what I'm saying. I think all of those things are very beneficial, but there's also a lot of research to suggest that particularly for young kids, like in elementary school, some of those things, particularly lockdown drills, can increase the anxiety of the children. And we also need to remember that most of the time the school shooters are coming from within the school itself. Sometimes they're a former student, like in the case of the St. Louis shooting, but they're going to be, you know, with the drills, the shooter's going to be, they're learning the drill at the same time as everybody else.
Thanks again for that call, Lynn. Robin, if somebody's listening who's involved with their school as an educator, an administrator, school board member, whatever, thinking, yeah, I'd like to do some of the things you're talking about. I'd like to boost this idea of students mattering to one another and to the community. What would you recommend as first steps?
You know, again, there's some schools that have already done it. So one thing I would recommend is that you know, the administrators do a search for schools that are and programs that are already out there that have been very successful in promoting it. Most of these programs are not ones that cost a lot of money, because, you know, you made the point about schools don't have a lot of resources, and so many schools now don't. So the programs that I know about that, you know, have implemented programs related to mattering are not requiring a lot of financial resources, but they seem to be meeting with a lot of success.
And how would those, if people adopt these programs, what does that look like? What kind of things actually happen in a school in just our last minute and a half or so if they adopt one of these mattering programs?
In terms of what they're actually doing, or what the effect of it is?
What they're doing, yeah.
Well, you know, just earlier I mentioned like the jigsaw, obviously it's a huge jigsaw or multiple jigsaws where the children are made to you know, not only for the student, him or herself, but for everyone to appreciate the uniqueness and the specialness of other students. In another one, in another school, one thing they do is, you know, because everybody's experiences are different, so it's called the Cross the Line Challenge. So they will have students, and they'll start with fairly innocuous questions like, you know, how many of you, I'm just totally making up some of these questions, but, you know, are over the age of 10 or whatever, and then they cross the line. But then the questions get more more detailed and more involved and more personal. You know, how many of you are children from divorced families? You know, because a lot of times when children are struggling with things, particularly at home, you know, they feel like they're the only person who has experienced that, and that they feel like that sets them apart and makes them isolated. But then when they engage in the Cross the Line Challenge, they realize that A, they're not alone, and B, that there's other people, other young people, their peers, that they can talk to about the issues that they're struggling with.
Robin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Robin Kowalski, Centennial Professor in the Department of Psychology at Clemson University. She joined us today for a look at ways to address some of the underlying conditions that she's identified as factors that correlate with school shootings, and how to create better school environments to hopefully prevent them from happening in the first place. The Wisconsin Republican Party reports that its list of election workers to staff the polls is three times longer than it was in 2020. It's a sign of emphasis on election logistics following former President Donald Trump's false claims that the election of 2020 was stolen. As Wisconsin Watch's Jacob Resnick reports, election officials say they're doing their best to reassure voters that the state's upcoming elections will be fair and secure.
Oconto County Clerk Kim Pitleski keeps a series of colorful, hand-drawn posters in her office. On one, she's written in marker, "Perception has become reality." It's a nod to the way election officials like her have come under serious, sometimes ill-informed scrutiny. She wants to reassure people that votes aren't being stolen, despite what they might read on social media.
People are throwing skepticism and these comments out there, but they're not doing the homework on what this really entails.
Frontline election workers are encountering not just questions, but outright hostility. It's fueled by former President Donald Trump's false claims that the 2020 election was stolen. Milwaukee election officials report receiving harassing calls, even death threats, leading officials to beef up security. The Madison metro area is preparing too. In Stoughton, clerks will have trauma kits and training for active shooter scenarios. City Clerk Candy Christian says Dane County had recommended these precautions.
It's a balance between trying to get our poll workers aware, but also not scare them away from being a poll worker.
One part of the Wisconsin Republican Party's response to the 2020 elections has been to invest in what it calls its Election Integrity Unit. In Green Bay, Brown County Republican Chair Jim Fitzgerald says historically, Republicans didn't recruit many poll workers.
When I came into office 4 years ago here, the list of poll workers I had were probably 90% unaffiliated, with very, very few Republicans. That's just the way it was done back then. You know, you try and have identified Republicans, but it wasn't that big a deal.
But it is a big deal now. And it goes back to what the county clerk in Oconto has said. Perception has become reality. Fitzgerald says his party needs to reassure its base, angry about Trump's defeat.
The issue has never been the 2020 election with us. It's been as a result of the 2020 election and as a result of how people reacted to it, we have to take care of their reactions.
And it's not just symbolic. Wisconsin election law allows whatever party's presidential or gubernatorial candidate that got the most votes at a precinct to nominate an extra election inspector at that polling place. That extra poll worker could be a tie-breaking vote if there's disagreement over whether to accept an absentee ballot questioned on technical grounds. The Republican Party says it sent 5,053 names to local clerks to work the polls, and that's a threefold increase over 2020. State Democratic officials wouldn't say how many party members they've signed up, but they point to their voter assistance hotline for anyone encountering problems at the polls. And while Republican officials may deny that they're focused on 2020, it's clear that some members of the party are angry about the chaos from voting during the first year of the pandemic. Marge Bostelman was county clerk in Green Lake for 24 years. And since 2019, she's been a Republican member of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. She says her experience as a clerk has guided her votes on the commission, even when it contradicts the party line. Things came to a head last year after she voted with Democrats to allow nursing home residents to vote absentee.
They wanted to make it clear that the Green Lake Republican Party denounced me because of my actions on the WEC.
A year later, the lifelong Republican is unrepentant for her work on the commission.
I'm not going to follow what the party wants me to do if it's detrimental for a municipal clerk to run a fair and honest election.
Back in Oconto, Republican County Clerk Pitleski says she's worried about this increasingly winners-take-all mindset in politics.
Because pendulums swing. You know, who's in power, sort of speak, that will swing. And we want to write election laws that are in place no matter which political party has the majority, because we all have to play by the same rules on this. Play nice in the sandbox.
Because even in her rural county, political polarization has pitted some neighbors against each other. And she says we can't let our communities be divided this way. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Jacob Resnick in Oconto.
Coming up after the news, false stories circulated about the attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, before the official police reports even came out. We'll talk to a misinformation expert about how these conspiracies spread, what effect they have, and what, if anything, can be done to slow the spread of bad information. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.